We're now about to launch into a theory of reality motivated and directed by belief in God. I've explained that that doesn't mean that we're going to deduce this theory from the scripture. It means that the transcendent creator is the only divinity that's going to be allowed to influence this theory. It's still a theory. It's still an explanatory guess that people make. It's still fallible. But I think it's a pretty good one. I'm impressed by it. Let's start where we left off last time, talking about aspects of reality. I took that term, an ordinary English term, and pressed it into a technical meaning. Its technical use here is for these kinds of properties and laws. And I'm hyphenating that so that you know that they go together. It's a kind of properties related by that kind of laws. There are laws that hold among quantitative properties, represented by numbers. There are laws that hold among physical properties of things, the sensory, the logical, and so on. The laws we're talking about here relate properties of the same kind. And these are the major kinds that people have distinguished in the last, say, 2,500 years that people have been making theories. So we're going to start with that. We're going to say, we'll start with this because it's the best approximation we have of just how people have seen reality around them. What the things that we experience exhibit to us. Do they exhibit that they have quantity? Yes. Do they occupy space? Yes. Do they have physical characteristics such as weight and mass and solidity? Yes. Some of them are alive. Some things perceive. Human beings think logically and have a formative capacity to take natural materials and make something new out of those materials. That's the formative or historical. One of the first things that they do is take sounds and mark some paper and create language. They have the sounds be symbols for other things. They have social relationships, economic, juridical ones having to do with the law, and aesthetic ones, ethical, having to do with right and wrong so far as love is concerned. The juridical has to do with what's just, the ethical with what's loving. And finally, fiduciary, this is the aspect for which Dewey's term is pistical, not a word you run into every day. He coined it. It comes from the Greek pistis, which means trust or faith. So this is an aspect of everything. We trust things all the time, to do this, not to do that, not to fall apart, and so on. And there are all degrees of that. At the upper end, there's what we trust unconditionally to be the unconditional reality. Then, so that trust is religious. But all the lower forms of it are not. They don't just relate to theology or to the doing of theology. So we're going to start with these aspects because they exhibit themselves in our experience. We take naive, pre-theoretical experience to be the world that God made and put us into. Not what materialists dismiss as illusion and call the manifest image that we all have. Yeah, it's a manifest image, all right. It's the world in which we live. We don't just have images of things like streetcars and buses. They're real. Stand in their way, you'll find out. So what we learn from this is if we start this way with the world as God made it, as He made it such that it presents itself to us, then we have to reject that metaphor that theories of reality has been built around. The metaphor of the necklace, remember? These are all the beads of the string. These are all the beads of the necklace. So what is the string? If these are the beads, if these are the kinds of properties and laws that things exhibit, then what are those things at their very core of their being such that they have these properties under those laws and they exhibit just to our experience just the way that they do? What explains that? Well, we're not going to have a string in this metaphor because that is an attempt to locate the divine within the world. It's an attempt to say that what unifies all these is, and then you pick one or two. If you pick matter, you're a materialist. If you pick the mathematical or logical, it's rationalism. You pick some one of those and say, this is self-existent. This can't fail to be the way it is. This is what generates everything else and orders it, when that is a role that belongs only to the transcendent creator who has revealed himself to us in Scripture. So we're going to reject the necklace metaphor. What metaphor would we use then? Well, it seems to me that a metaphor of a necklace, again, would be all right if all the strands of it were interwoven very tightly, no one of which is what supports all the rest. And then what supports the whole thing is the maker of the necklace, which is not part of the necklace. That's a more appropriate metaphor for the way we want to do theory of reality. We also have to notice that these properties are exhibited by the things that have them in two senses. I started to explain that last time, so I'm coming back to that now. The solid bars down here represent what I called a things having this kind of properties actively. And I'm distinguishing here active over against passive. And the example I thought I gave last time, won't hurt if I give it again, or if I didn't, let's do it now. Quantitative. The Earth is the third planet from the sun. It's the third planet from the sun, whether you know that or I know that, or even if no one knows it, it would still be the third planet from the sun. But the Earth also has the passive property of being countable. And if it didn't have that property, we could not count it. Do you understand why? Because then we'd be saying, I counted that, and it's the third property from the sun, but it doesn't have the property of being able to be counted. That's self-contradictory. So it can't be right. So the Earth has the passive property as well as an active one. Something can be spatially active or passive. It can be spatially active because it occupies a specific space and has a specific shape to that space. And then we can say it's also movable. We can be pushed around. It can be moved in space. That's a passive property. Something can be passively kinetic or passively physical. Active physical properties are things like solidity, weight, mass. Things have those whether we know it or not. But then, something can be physically passive. We can weigh it. We can find out what its weight is. We can measure it. It's measurable. It's able to be weighed, and so on. And things have logical properties passively. And right away here, this makes a big difference in our theory by the role in which it casts logic. Because almost every other theory of reality I've ever encountered does not recognize passive logical properties. It recognizes only the active ones. So the theory holds that only propositions and arguments have logical properties. A proposition is either true or false, if it's a genuine proposition. Proposition arranges premises of an argument, relate to the conclusion by entailing the conclusion, or they don't entail the conclusion. If they do, it's a valid argument. If they don't, it's invalid. But that's all logic has to do with, we are told. Just arguments, language. Not so. Every object that we experience has passive logical properties. The passive logical property, for example, of being distinguishable from other things. If it didn't have that, you couldn't distinguish it. You would not have recognized it as an individual. Things have the logical property of being conceivable. We can abstract or notice any number of properties that a thing has, distinguish each of them, and form a concept that combines them. My concept of this thing is that it has these following properties. So logic is an aspect of the whole of reality, not just of our thought or just of arguments and propositions. Similarly, we have the ability to form natural materials and make other things out of them. This is going to be our view of artifacts. And Doiwer is going to have a very compelling theory about artifacts and how the nature of the raw material changes as it undergoes formation. I know of only one other thinker who tried to give us a theory of artifacts to explain how a thing is different when a natural from what it is as a natural material and when it undergoes transformation and becomes something else. Aristotle tried it, couldn't make it work, and gave up. I think Doiwer's view is very convincing, so we'll have a look at that too. So this is also very important, to distinguish the active from the passive. Something can be passive economically. A rock doesn't economically value anything, but it can be economically valued. It can be passive. It can be bought and sold. Something can be juridically passive. You and I are juridically active. We want to know what laws are. As citizens, we take part in voting for people who make them so that we have a say in lawmaking and so on. But then something can be juridically passive. My automobile belongs to me. It's juridically mine. Somebody steals it, they have committed a crime, a breaking of the law, because they did something unjust. Same thing is true about all the others. Something can be ethically passive. Ethics has to do, I said last time, with law, with love relations. It's human love life. Humans love or hate a whole range of things all over the whole spectrum of their experience. We love or hate, things are loved or hated. So I can say, you know, that suit of clothes that I bought from so-and-so back in whatever year, I really loved that. That was best suit I've ever owned. Or, remember the car I bought? I hated that sucker. That thing gave me nothing but trouble from the day I got it. That's all ethical. It has to do mainly, however, of course, with the way we treat other humans. We're to treat them in love and not in hate. We're to love our neighbors as ourselves. That's an ethical commandment. The religious one is, at love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. There's no limit to that. No limit. With our whole being, we're to love God. But our neighbor, it's a balance between our neighbor's interests and benefits and our own. We're not to put our neighbor above ourselves all the time. It doesn't say that. It says balance the two. As yourself. So that's the difference between the moral commandment and religious. Well, what I want to do now is go into some of these aspects more thoroughly. But before I do, there's more that you need to know. First of all, I've already tried to explain that we have a different take on these just because the divine, which is only God, that generates them, that has produced them, has produced the world of which these are true, the divine stands outside creation. The divine isn't identical with any of these. It's not that it's the quantitative properties of things qualify the nature of whatever is self-existent, or the physical does, or the sensory, or the logical, and so on. And that's the way philosophy has always been done by people who did not know God. Unfortunately, it was continued that way by people who did. And I'm saying, friends, there's another way to go. Because we're not deifying any of these, none of these are what generate all the rest, and none are what all the rest depend on. We went through that last time. This is a bit of review. Now, this being so, we can see why it is that people who don't know God, when they're confronted with this, say, well, it has to be some one or two of these, has to be the nature of the divine reality. What else is there? What else could it be? Since they don't know God outside of all of these, what else could it be? So it's got to be one. And then they pick whatever looks most plausible to them to be the nature of the divine reality, that which produces everything else. And so what they do is engage in a process that is called these days a reduction argument. Now, that sounds as though it might be a diet plan for losing weight or something, but that's not what it means. What it means is that we take the aspect or two that we regard as the nature of what it is that's self-existent, and now we reduce everything else to this. That's one way of arguing for the divinity of this. Everything else can be explained in terms of this. This can't be explained in terms of the others. That's one sense of reduction. Here's another sense of reduction. This one is the one that generates all the others. So we can learn, we can trace out causal pathways. We can show that these others depend on this one, and this one doesn't depend on them. That's the second sense. We could also try to reduce it this way. We can argue there really are no other aspects. There's only this. And that's a very strong reductive argument that tries to get rid of the other kinds altogether and say there's only this one that I... This is the one I've put my money down, I take this one. This is what explains everything. That's a very difficult thing to do because unless you allow that whatever aspect you pick is accompanied at least by the logical aspect, what you end up doing is offering logical arguments for the conclusion that nothing has any logical properties and there are no logical laws. And that's an absurd position to be in. There are people there. Make no mistake. So these are all senses of reduction, trying to show the superiority of one or two of the aspects over all the rest, so as to conclude that that one or two is, in fact, the divine reality they all depend on, the nature of the divine reality. Now, what I want to do next is go through the kinds of incoherencies that arise when people try these reduction arguments. So we'll take a break here, and we'll come back and look at what's wrong with reduction arguments.